Good afternoon, and you're very welcome to All Points North. We're out and about for the first part of the programme today in the county of Cavan. We're in West Cavan on the shores of Templeport Lake, looking over to St Mogues Island, because in a little while during the course of the programme we'll be going to St Mogues Island. Why are we here? Well, let's find out from Peter McVitie, who is the chairman of a local committee who've organised events to come along on the 16th of July, very special events. Peter, tell me the background to all of this.
Well, I got involved in this, Donna, back about 2 weeks ago. There's a committee set up. It's got to do with a plane that came down in St Patrick's Night in 1943, and there was two pilot and a navigator on it, and had to bail out of the plane and the parachute out of it, and one arrived at Corlett, beside Corlett Chapel, and the other one arrived down beside Swedland Bar. The navigator arrived beside Swedland Bar, and the pilot arrived at Corlett Chapel, and the plane eventually crash landed on St Mogues Island, or just close to it. And that's 63 years ago. So now the pilot is in Australia. He's still alive. He's 89. And they're coming back to Ireland on a tour. And they're just going to... It's an honour him be coming back. And there's something going to be arranged for the 16th here in Templeport. And I got involved in the committee. And it's the more you get involved in it, the more interesting it gets. Between trying to find pieces of the plane, the divers out here for the last 2 days... And they've got pieces, if you've seen here yourself, Donna, and it's very interesting as you watch it. So the people that are involved mostly in this now are the local man that knows a lot about history here is Oliver Brady and Nigel, and Isabel is a secretary, and as you said, Jeff McCaffrey is the treasurer. And it's a very interesting committee to be on, and I think that these people that have went into the history and the people have been diving will fill you in, Donna, an awful lot of what has been going on since the last few days.
Well, let's talk to the various people that Peter has mentioned. We'll go across to the history man who knows all about this. Oliver Brady, they've described you as the local historian in this respect. This is before your living memory, of course.
Aye, it would be.
I suppose most people's in the area.
Well, I remember as a kid my father and his contemporaries speaking about it. It wouldn't be now... It wouldn't be a burning issue, but it would come up occasionally in conversation. And I look at it at various levels. From a local history point of view, it's fascinating. All the bits of the jigsaw are slowly coming into place. We didn't know much about the pilots. We didn't even know whether they had survived the war. It was a question that people often asked: did they survive? Only maybe 8 to 10 people might have had actually contact with the crew. And they got back across the border, as you know from the booklet, shortly after the crash. There's another equally interesting point of view. If you look at it from just a pure human interest point of view, well, two Stenzers came down, and well, it wasn't hostile territory, but
it was neutral territory.
It was neutral territory, but the people could have easily turned them over to the police. Eventually, they would have been released, but they realised that these people were in trouble. And
well, the speculation was that they took a flight from the Isle of Islay on the Scottish coast.
Local speculation would seem to think that it might have come from Enniskillen, or that they might have crossed the land border at one stage. And then there was various. It was all speculation. Nobody knew the precise story until Richard Kukura told it, or sent the details over to us. And he did an invaluable service to people like me that would be interested in local history, and that he filled in a major part of the jigsaw. There's still a few little bits left, the jigsaw left, but Willie Seaman has unearthed most of them, and Eddie Brogan, the divers. Most of the plane went back to Enniskillen, probably Castle Archdale, but there are still a few little bits. There was a lot of speculation about an engine, whether it was there, whether
what
it wasn't.
Type of plane was it?
It was a Bristol Beaufighter, twin-engined fighter plane. It would be lightly armed. It would be a heavy fighter or light bomber type. It could carry torpedoes and small bombs, but normally it was used as a fighter. It would be about its dimensions were, it was about 40, 47 feet long and 52 foot wingspan, which would be considerable. It would be not dissimilar to an Arctic thrush, I suppose, in size.
It certainly would have made a fuss if it was flying over the skies.
Then it kept coming down in ever-decreasing circles and flew quite low and frightened the living daylights of a lot of people around here, you know. I would know uncles of mine, my father, his contemporaries. It flew in an area around, mostly around, generally around the borders of Templeport, and it began to come in ever-decreasing circles until it crashed upside down on the lake shore.
And but for luck, could have crashed it, on some it, people it, or it, houses
well,
or had, otherwise.
It yeah. could have had. Now, people might say, well, that was the pilot's fault. It wasn't. They ran out of fuel. So they had no option to put the bail out. Put yourself in their position. And from Tommy Hume's daughter's account, from what Tommy Hume was the navigator, she seemed to think that, from what I've read of her account, from what Tommy told her, he didn't know whether he was over land or sea. He was delighted when he heard a dog barking as he came down and landed in Boggy Field in Corner. So
he was just hoping for the best.
He was hoping for the best. Although now, in fairness, Richard Kukura had been flying blind for over a couple hundred miles, and his calculations weren't too far out, a few miles south of where he was intending to go. But that's basically it. But the story of the engine, we had reason to believe that the engine was in the lake, and oil started to appear here, there and yonder. The divers were searching. Willie Seaman, he was the diver, he's from Black Lion or Belcoo country, and we were beginning to wonder where this oil was coming from and was the engine there. But we've discovered what happened to the engine. The engine was there, but it was smashed into fragments with the impact. So that's another part of the jigsaw filled in. So that's
As the time progressed, you were finding out more and more about it because of that. What they might call the forensics of that.
Yeah, yeah. It's just like it's classic. It's like I'm just watching there now, assembling the little bits of it, and it's like that classic, almost like classic archaeology. The pot, you know, the pot shells all around the place, and they'll gradually begin to come together. So we won't have a completely intact engine, but we have certainly enough to know that it is the engine anyway. And those boys, certainly Willie Seaman knows the stuff about engines. He obviously he has extracted lots of them before, because we certainly have the engine. Not 2 tons of engine, but maybe two stone of engine. But
And something is better than nothing.
Oh, it certainly is. And obviously, as that comedian, what do you call him, Jim Cricket, says, and there's more.
But, come here, there's more. Jimmy Cricket.
There's more, yeah.
Oliver, thanks very much.
Okay.
Oliver Brady there with an insight to the history of this. So let's talk to Willie Seaman. Willie, in among some of the stuff that's been collected, and it looks, well, looking at it, if you didn't know what it was, you'd say it's a bit of a mess, but you can discern the different parts that you found there. First of all, how deep did you have to go?
Well, it wasn't terribly deep, but just I suppose it's maybe 6 foot down to sort of bedrock. But it had to pass through the vegetation on the surface, and then the mud, and then like boulder clay with big stones in it, you know.
So it's fairly dark down there, even though you're only a few feet down.
Oh, it's always dark. Oh, it's black. You know, once you disturb the silt and stuff like that, there's no chance.
So how do you recognise that anything's there? Because you haven't really got the sense of touch, do you?
Well, you can tell. You can tell whenever you lift a stone that it's a stone and not man-made, you know. Yeah. Although there's square stones in there too.
But so just what have you extracted in this pile here, for example, that looks like lots of small broken pieces of bakelite or otherwise. Now here's a circular piece here. What exactly is this?
The crown of a piston.
So this is part of the engine.
It would have been in two parts, obviously, you know, because it would have had been longer than that, you know. But
so in diameter that's about 6 to 7 inches.
Oh, 6 inches or so, yeah. Been a fairly big engine. It'd been I don't know, 20 litres, 30 litres, something.
How many pistons that size would there be?
14
of them, so it is fairly substantial.
Two rows and a radial.
And is that the first piston that's been found?
Oh, no, the boys must have visited the site before and pulled the bits of it out, because there'd been a lot more of them, you know. There'd have been complete liners as well.
And this is the liner you're looking at now, or at least a part of that liner. What's that made of? It seems to have broken and shattered.
Just aluminium alloy.
An alloy. I suppose that's because of the circumstances of war. They had to make them with alloys. It might have been that bit cheaper than steel or otherwise.
All the bits of an aeroplane are made of aluminium because it's light. So the lighter you have it, the more better performance you have,
yes,
more lifting capacity. You know.
Yes, it's going to fly for longer too, perhaps, because it's not as yeah. It's more cost effective to fly it then.
No, it would have taken a few pounds to keep that running in gasoline.
It wasn't as effective as the diesel engines of today then.
No. But then, whenever there's war, expense is not an issue.
Yes, I suppose the armaments business will certainly confirm that for us. Here's another piece, a longer piece, a long, thin...
Some sort of a strut out of the workings of the plane, you know. I don't know where it would have been. Could have been anywhere in it. If you had an engineering drawing of it, you could probably pick out the parts, you know.
Yes.
But they're in good shape because they were down in the mud, you see. Mm-hmm. And then they'd stay in the mud, like, for years and years, maybe centuries. Because there'd have been... a substantial amount of engine oil to help preserve them.
Here's a much smaller piece now. It's kind of a next shape piece, elongated, you might say. What is that piece with lots of coil running around it?
I have no idea. It must be some sort of a...
part of the radio.
Is it part of the radio? It's part of a radio, then. Yeah. I wouldn't be really much into radios. Engines would be more my bit. But it's in good shape as well, you know.
Not corroded by being under the water.
No.
That's silver coated wire.
Is it? No, silver coated.
Yeah.
So. Eddie Brogan seeming to have a bit of knowledge there as to what that piece was.
I'm learning as I go along here, you know.
Yeah. You're up on the surface.
I'm in the boat on top. Willie's down underneath, right? I'm the guy on top. Handing them out tools and keeping the air bottles full and keeping the pumps running. Keeping the pressure pump running. Just keeping the show on the road above the water.
The fact that it's a shallower depth to go down than many other places, does that make it safer?
I don't know. It makes it more difficult for getting parts out. If it was deeper water, you'd have a better lift with your buoyancy to get the parts from the bottom up. When you have a short lift, it's more physical. You're actually using body power, manpower to get parts to the surface. But as well as that, it's very, very muddy. Once you touch the bottom at all, you're covered in silt and you lose visibility completely. That's one of the disadvantages of the shallow work. Yeah.
But you still find it fascinating?
I do indeed. Well, I'm interested in World War II memorabilia, you know. Always was.
It's like a treasure hunt,
yeah.
Have you come across any other lakes in Fermanagh, well, where you're both from? Or
Lochearn, yes.
Lochearn. So you're used to finding things of this nature?
Oh, I've spent 20 years at it. Like. So you just find different stuff every day, you know. And it's a different thing every day, you know.
Well, one piece that you've come up with in the dive, a very interesting piece. I can recognise that as the shell from a gun, but it must be a fairly large gun.
It's a very large bullet, yes. 20mm cannon shell. Mm-hmm. And the bowfighter had four of these underneath, directly underneath the pilot, under the nose. And these would have been submarine busters. Other armament on the airplane. She had three 303 on one wing and four on the other wing. So she was very well armed.
Has this one been fired? Obviously has.
No. If you look at it closely, you'll see, right, the primer is still intact, which means it hasn't been fired, right? Yet the shell, there's no bullet on the shell.
Okay.
But you can tell by looking at it, it's bell mouth at the top, which is evident that this shell exploded in impact.
Okay. So
and blew its top off. And so the proof is the primer is intact.
It's about an inch in diameter and about
20mm. 20mm cannon shell.
20mm wide and what, about 3.5 inches long?
Four.
4 inches, as it were.
And then you have much longer then when you have the projectile in front of it, you're attached.
I can remember a full projectile.
Yeah.
About maybe 6 inches.
Yeah. All over it, you know. Yeah. Yeah. But these aircraft were used for submarine and ship hitting, you know. They'd have been... the U-boat's worst enemy. Mm-hmm. And they were a very efficient aircraft because they were very, very silent. In fact, the Japanese called them whispering death. They were so much afraid of them due to the sleeve valve engines that they had on them. They could come in on them almost unannounced. They were being fired at before they realised what was firing at them. And that was the bowfighter.
What's up here?
I think.
Right. Okay, yes. Yeah, turn that round to there.
So this is putting on the life jacket, which is crucially safe, Nigel. You won't allow anybody on the boat unless they have one of these, which is the proper way to do it, isn't it?
I hope so.
Well, we've jumped onto the boat. Nigel is doing the rowing. I will get talking to Nigel later. But with me is Kevin McCaffrey. Kevin, you're the treasurer of the organising committee, but this lake, Templeport Lake, it's in St. Rogue's Island, this is nothing new to you. You fished here as a youngster?
Yeah, for years and years, for the Great Lake, for trawling in Longo. We used to often go and take a cup of tea on the island.
Because I see there's a cemetery on it.
Very quiet neighbours.
Was there a church on it?
Yeah, you've seen the walls of it there. You see the walls of the church there.
So a very, very peaceful and serene place.
It is indeed.
At the moment.
It is indeed.
What are your impressions of this idea of getting the whole celebration of the incident?
I'd love it now. I'd heard about it all my life. Like, I live in the next town, Landjust. I heard it was a plane crash all my life, so I'm very interested in it. I suppose only for Nigel it would never have been got off the ground, like he happened to get in contact with the people in Australia and that. So I'm very interested in it.
In the distance there, the hills above Ballyconnell.
That's right. And the
Slieve Rushen, of course.
Slieve Rushen and the windmills is all up there as well.
We're getting plenty of good wind today. We're getting a wee bit of wind on the surface as well.
Yeah.
Those two central ones are there.
It's very nice and peaceful out here, and very few people are buried on the island now, but I dug several graves on it in my time. Several. Well, there'll be always a few of us.
Yes, I suppose I think they kept within the families who have been
there. That's right. The last man was buried here, I think, was a man the name of James Curtin from Corla, and Paddy McHugh. They were the last two of us.
And how long ago was that?
Long ago was that, Peter? About 2 or 3 years ago. 2 years ago.
As recent as that.
That's right. And there's another few people going to be.
That must cause great problems getting a boat organised.
No, they've a boat. The council has a boat here, and there's no problem at all. I remember one time we came out here with an old man that's from Bonby, and it was the last time they came out in an old cot that here, and the wind raised up, so we couldn't go back into the cottage where they go out to the church. But the wind, we couldn't go back in with the wind. So that was the only time.
Well, we're coming close to the shore at the other side, and we've got a jetty organised.
Landing raft. This man will tell you all about that now.
There's the landing raft at the side. Is that where some of the diving control took place from, Willie?
Yeah, it was put together sort of optimistically, as you can see, because we thought we'd have got a whole complete engine, but it didn't transpire that way, you know. But
so this was to take the extra weight if it was needed?
Yeah, well, it's more for the lift heavier objects, you know.
That's the exact place there where the plane came down.
Aye. Just less than 40 yards from the actual island itself.
20 years to
go. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, if it had stayed in the air for another few seconds, it had been on the island.
Half a second.
That's right. But it came in and it landed very hard, you know.
And subsequently there's not much of it left then.
Well, the authorities at the time would have tidied up as much as they could, but they probably left the engines behind, you know, because they'd have been smashed to bits. It was easier to make new ones than it was to repair old ones, maybe.
Well, we're just coming into the jetty and we're going to disembark, as they say in the best ships. Well, Nigel has been our boatman, rowing valiantly across. Nigel, you've rowed this lake for many years. You have a record to upkeep of a couple of minutes from the shore.
Oh, that was when I was a child. That was a long time ago. I used to row out on my school holidays. I used to row out here in a somewhat bigger boat, but an easier boat to row because it had a better keel than that flat-bottomed one. And used to make it from the reeds on one side to the reeds here in 2 minutes, sort of slightly under 2 minutes.
So you know this story as long as anyone knows the story of the bullfighter?
Well, no, not true. I certainly wouldn't be as old as some of my neighbours who remember the night it happened. Aidan McGovern, who lives over there, remembers the night very well. His sister was one of the few people who actually saw the plane, because it was, of course, dark, and most people heard it, and by the time they went out to look, it had gone. It flew round, we think, 5 times in ever-decreasing circles as it was banking more, so it had more lift on the upper wing and banked even tighter. And eventually it was flying in very small circles. So it came in across Corboy Hill over there, across where those farm buildings are now, in this direction, but again, because of the circle, came in from the north, so from where we are behind the raft and down there. As I say, it was very, very tight circles at that stage. The earlier circles we found were from even as far as Newton Gore and Carrigallen earlier, Corrawillan, Ahawillan and Corrawillan. I've always been interested in the aeroplane, but I knew very little about it. Some friends of mine, Pattersons, who were at the time living in Ardloha, Kildallan, asked questions and I couldn't answer them. I had even forgotten that it was a bowfighter or what a bowfighter was. So John Patterson, who was particularly interested in World War II aircraft and originally from New Zealand, and I did some research, and on the internet we found the website of Dennis Buck, who runs the belligerent air crashes in Ireland during the Second World War. And the bowfighter was listed there, so we contacted him, and he didn't have any details, but he contacted David Earle, who suggested that we contact the Royal Air Force Museum at Hendon, outside London, and they were able to give us the crash report, which was logged the next day or the day after. That would have been, I think, the 18th of March or the 19th of March. And from there we had the pilot's name, R. Kukura, and his service number. So, John Patterson, who is a genealogist, searched the genealogical websites and the web forums, and he found a Stephanie Kukura, who had been searching for her husband's ancestors 2 or 3 years previously. Now, extraordinarily, she still had the same email address, and when he wrote to her, she replied that she was indeed married to a nephew of the pilot of the aeroplane. That was really the start of it. That would have been over 2 years ago. And we wrote to each other, mostly by email through Stephanie Kukura, and his daughter, Nikki. He wrote the story for us. He had apparently said very little about the crash to his two daughters or, you know, his other relations. But when we asked, he wrote several A4 pages for us of what happened from the time he left Port Ellen in Islay, that's in the Hebrides of Scotland, to the time he got back to what we think was Kinnorley, and then to Loch Ness.
Richard Kukura, thank you very much for joining us. You're 89. We're taking you back 63 years with our story that we're talking about today. How much do you remember of that particular night, way back St. Patrick's Day in 1943?
Well, I think I remember most of it. Like my navigator, of course, he didn't remember all that much. And when I spoke to him about it, he said, well, it's 50 years have passed, and I'm not very up with it. But I think that I still can remember quite a lot.
You set off from Scotland earlier in the evening, and you were flying wherever you were, but you ended up coming over skies, and you didn't know where you were. Take the story up for us as to what happened.
Yes, we were doing a test on the bowfighter for petrol consumption, etc., and also navigation. And we went to Rockall. You must know the island or the rock out in the Atlantic. And from there we went to St. Kilda, further to the north, and from there we went to the northwest corner of Scotland, and from there we headed for home. And just after dark, my navigator's hatch burst open, and as he happened to be using the radio just before then, and it was in its out position on the cantilever, the hatch hit the radio and smashed it. And so we were left without any, you know, connection with the base. So then we had to try and get back to base in this stormy night with a 3,000-foot mountain by the side of the runway, and with no actual definite means of having knowing how our navigation was, how accurate it was. And so I decided to go through the overcast and see if we could find a gap somewhere else. So we didn't find anything. We hunted. I did a square search and couldn't find anything. And so I decided to fly south to maybe find better weather. And after about half an hour's flying, I saw a light reflected on the cloud in front of me, and I realized that there was a hole in the cloud. And coming over the hole, I saw double set of lights, which seemed to be a runway, but most likely a city. I dived down onto these lights and pulled out at about 300 feet and flew west. It was a city, and the lights were well alight. I flew from there out over the beach and over the, I could see the white caps of the waves, and I realized that we were then on the west coast of Ireland, probably Northern Ireland, according to what my memory told me about the map of North and South Ireland. So I tried to remember where I might be and what city it might be, and I decided on Donegal. That meant that I would have to fly east to try and get as far in to cross the border, which ran north and south at that particular place. And so in order to be able to get back into Allied territory. Well, that didn't quite happen. We ran out of petrol before we quite made it, and we had to bail out. I sent Tommy out to first, and then I jumped myself. And luckily, I landed by not far from a house. But unluckily, I landed in the ruins of an old wall, and they damaged me actually for life. My spine is not very good now.
Because of that circumstance. And then you met some people quite close by. Did they come looking for you, or did you call out for them?
No. They were looking. Apparently, my airplane, after I left it, circled once or twice before it crashed. And they came out to see what was going on, I guess. And when I hit the ground, I was hardly conscious for about 10 minutes. And when I woke up, I gathered myself together, and I saw the reflection of light from this house, and I called out, "Is anybody there?" And two voices came back, and then I saw these shadows separate from the trees, and it was a man and a boy, as I thought then. And they invited me into the house, and so I was sort of very pleased to have some shelter.
And they continued to offer you hospitality. I believe you had bacon and eggs.
Yes, that's right. They gave me bacon and eggs, and then in the, I think it was about midnight when I told them that I would have to get on my way, because they had told me I was on, in Southern Ireland, and I told them I'd have to get on my way to get over the border to safety. And they wanted me to sleep there, and I told them no, I couldn't do that. But then they offered to send the boy for somebody who knew something about this sort of work. And so I agreed to that, and I waited for about 40 minutes, and the boy came back with a man who, as was promised, he finally guided me over the border, and he went to the nearest police station and brought a car back for me to pick me up, and I slept at the police station. Next morning, I had good news that they'd found my navigator, and he had crossed the border in the evening. So I was taken to where my navigator was staying, and we were both taken to an Australian Air Force squadron on the Loch Ney. That's the
yes,
one.
Yes, Loch Ney.
Yeah, that's the one we went to.
Did you?
And I spent 5 days there recovering from my injury, and with a bit of luck, we found an Australian squadron further around the lake, a training squadron, and they gave us a ride back to the Isle of Islay. So that was, in short, that's what happened.
Did you ever return to Ireland?
No, I've never been back. I'm unfortunately never was able to get back.
There are many people in the area who would love to meet you. I don't know if the people involved in the Mahira area are still living, the people who helped you
yes.
on that occasion, but were you able to make contact with them since?
Only through this, where you and I are now, through emails and so on. My nephew and his wife will very shortly be with you people in Ireland.
And they'll
they're
be...
Making, they're at the moment, I think, they're in Yugoslavia.
They're making their way to County Cavan.
Yes, they're going to come to your the village and so on, and to meet all you people.
The invitation once again will be extended for you to come to Ireland. You'd be more than welcome. There'd be lots of people who'd like to meet you. But we appreciate you very much, Richard, for taking our call, and best wishes to everyone in Australia.
Yes, yes, yes. Thank you.
What was the other the co-pilot's name?
Tommy Hulme, but it's spelt H-U-L-M-E.
He's deceased since.
He unfortunately died in 1995, but he has a wife still alive, but unfortunately not very well, and at least two daughters and lots of grandchildren.
But no recollections coming from
yes,
that side?
Yes, there have. His daughter Elizabeth Rothwell wrote a piece of what she remembers him telling, and we expect to have more from some of the grandchildren who spoke at length to him about his wartime activities.
So you're going to piece more of that human side of the jigsaw?
Well, we hope to. We hope to. Four of them are coming on the 16th of July.
Well, Kevin, this is St. Moog's Island, called after the saint who was born here.
He was St. Moog is Irish for my Eog, my young maiden, for I always heard anyway.
There's a legend to his birth.
Yes, he was supposed to be born on the island, and the child was here and they wanted to get it baptised. And they were supposed to shout out to a priest on the shore, there was a child to be baptised, and they had no boat to bring him out. So we told them to get a flat stone and put him on it and push the stone out. And it's supposed to have been at the shore, the child was baptised, they put on the stone and it came back again. And the stone was used for years to bring coffin out to be buried in it. History has it that some courting couple went on a one night and the stone
broke in two, and half went down, the other half went into the shore. So there's part of it in Bonby Church now at the moment for Holy Water Fund.
My goodness. So that's been kept. There's another legend about taking clay from the island.
Yes, St. Mogue's clay is supposed to be prevented from being drowning and fire. So the lady, one or two people from Corla was on the Titanic when it went down, and she had St. Mogue's clay with her, and she was saved.
A McGovern, I understand.
I don't know if she McGovern. Was she McGovern, I think. I wouldn't be sure of her name now. I wasn't around that time.
She survived the Titanic.
She survived the Titanic. She's not too long dead now. She'll only be a few years dead. So as you can see, it's a very peaceful place to be. And I suppose if the other people die in the green here. So
Oliver, you've just gone and you've got me a little piece of the clay there, so I should be safe from the
You're supposed to be safe from fire and other disasters. I heard of a lady on the Titanic was supposed to be saved because of, and I've heard another story quite recently of a raging fire in a chimney and the two in the little pinch of Mogue's clay and the fire went out just like that. Now, as I say, I suppose it's some say it's superstition, but obviously if it happened, the man that told me, he's very reliable. It wasn't a figment. I wouldn't say it was a figment of his imagination by any means.
So plenty of people still believe it?
Well, certainly of the older, we'll say, generation do. As regards to the younger people, I don't know. There's not a great tradition of younger people coming to the island now. But it is the birthplace of St. Mogue or St. Aidan, my young Aidan and my young Hugh. A very prominent churchman in the... He was born about, I think, 550. And he moved... he trained in Fenner, Dumlane. He ended up in Port Manoch in Wales. That's named after him. He came back to Ferns. Died in Ferns. Reputedly... No, got ill in Ferns. Moved back to Dumlane. Died in Dumlane. And was reputedly buried in St. Invar. Or in Ross Invar in Leitham, in an old abbey graveyard up there. But then, if you go to the Church of Ireland Cathedral in Wexford, they'll tell you that he's buried under the altar there. And you know the song Bull of Og, Mogue's Bully, Mogue's Hut. That they reckon that it's the same man. So he was Bishop of Ferns. He definitely was regarded as Bishop of Ferns. And there would have been, after his time, I suppose, because the island was associated with him, that church was built. And it's small, but as you can see, the remains of a quite substantial church. And it would have been... there's tombstones in it. It's a burial ground. It's been a burial ground. I think there are stones there that would go back to the 1700s. And it's quite overgrown. And also, it was a place of worship here until about 1485. And I think there are Vatican records which then suggests that the church has moved to the mainland where the present St. Peter's Church of Ireland is. It would have acted as a Catholic church until about 1609, till the plantation of Ulster.
Well, Peter, we began our journey the other side of the lake. We're in the centre of it now. This is going to be a hive of activity on Sunday the 16th.
That's correct, yeah. We plan to come out here sometime around lunchtime on the Sunday and just take come across here, and then hopefully after a short time here we go back down to the community centre, a bit of a get together and a few sandwiches and that type of thing, and then there'll be a presentation made to the two families of the pilot and the navigator. There's two paintings that's by a local artist here in the area. He's Patty Duffy, and it'll just be a drawing of the plane and the lake and the island, and it'll just be a momentum and a memory of that infamous night of what happened, you know. That's just hoped to be.
It's already been a serene place to be while we were on the lake, but when we're on the island, there's a serenity about here too, isn't there?
There is. It's lovely and peaceful here, you know. And I suppose it's very derelict at the minute, you know, but if it could be got cleaned up properly, it's a beautiful place and very peaceful. There's a lot of history to it, you know, and it's great to see something like this being brought back to life again, that people can remember what happened in the past and it's just something that will, when it's mentioned after 63 years, it'll not be forgotten for another few years, and then something else happens, you know. So it's great to see it, and I'm very happy to be involved in it, Donna. It was a great pleasure to be invited onto the committee, and let's hope that there'll be good turnout on the day and that the weather will be good, that we'll be able to do what we hope to do, they're able to come across on a boat, and that everybody will enjoy it, and it'll be a day to remember.
Undoubtedly, many people will be fascinated with the whole idea of a trip to St. Mogues Island, but if you can't physically go on the 16th, there is an opportunity to find out more about this, what's described as the Irish Adventure of Richard Kakura and Tommy Hume, on a website. Let's find out about, Nigel, you've designed this website, lots of interesting aspects to it. Tell me about the design.
Well, I can't claim to be a professional website designer, certainly not. I learned by trial and error, and I've put a few websites together. They're indexed from bornboy.com, and bornboy.com itself has rather a strange history. I don't know, you're probably not interested in that.
Oh,
so
tell us that we are.
Oh. Well, I was trying to persuade some of the local businesses in the area to register the name bornboy.com, just so that nobody else could get it and that we could use it for community use. I also wanted to register a few other similar names, but nobody seemed to be interested. So I spoke to my daughter about this over a year ago, and she said, well, why don't I do it? And she offered to give it to me. And we set about it, and in about 2 or 3 hours, one night, we not only had it registered, but we had a page on it, a holding page on it, that said, this is the home of bornboy.com, and we're going to put some things here. And that's how it happened. Now there are links to it, and if people want to put pages up, they're welcome to make contact, and I will put on pages or links for local businesses and non-commercial activities in the area.
Well, coming back to the site for the crash, as it were, let's hope your site that it's on doesn't crash too often. I'm sure it won't, but there's plenty of information, plenty of photographs, and
yes, some of them taken by myself, but many of them taken by relatives of the crew of the aeroplane, and indeed a few others. Kukuras were kind enough to give me photographs of themselves. The wedding picture taken in Cairo of Richard and his wife Olga.
He's quite a dapper looking man with a fine moustache as well. And
indeed. Well, that was just after he left here. That was July when he went to Egypt and met his future wife.
And he doesn't look too much the worse for wear, does he?
Absolutely not. He's still very tall and an amazing man. There in front of you, you've got a picture of him and his two daughters at his wedding anniversary in July 2003. That is a picture of his sister at her 90th birthday with Olga, Richard, another sister, the 90-year-old birthday girl, his daughter, and Brian and Stephanie Kukura. Brian is his nephew, Stephanie is Brian's wife, and they are the two people that are coming over on Sunday the 16th.
Let's talk to Isabel. Isabel's been involved in this project. Isabel went under the water and discovered a few things herself. You've got really involved in this too.
I have indeed.
What's the reason for the enthusiasm?
I grew up with this story. I mean, when others were listening to Goldilocks, I was listening to the plane that went down on Port Lake. And then I suppose just as time, I came back a year ago, bought a house, and all this research was going on. So you can't help but be interested. I mean, it's a fantastic story. And I think what really interests me is there's history, but now the present has become history. And, you know, if I'm ever lucky, you know, in 20, 30, 40 years' time, the children that will be hearing these stories will have so much more information than I had. I mean, the myth, you know, there's more to it now, and we know the characters involved, and you know, the local aspect, the fact that people helped, you know, these guys survive and get to the north, and, you know, incredible from every aspect. And I think, you know, much respect to the researchers and whatnot that have, you know, got this together and got the information. You know, now we just need to get a lot of money together to help things along.
Well, the events themselves get underway on the 16th,
yes,
but there's another event.
We're holding a race night in the Keeper's Arms in Bomboy on the 14th, on Friday the 14th of July, and we certainly hope to raise, you know, money from that. So any of your listeners that want to come along and support us, fantastic. You know, there's money to be won and money to raise, so it should be a good night for all involved.
Finally, back to yourself, Nigel, something you wanted to say before we finish. Give us the website address again.
There are links to bornboy.com. There are links from bornboy.com to lots of bornboy-related sites, including the website that I spoke to you about, and also the website of Dennis Burke, who has the air crashes during World War II that happened in Ireland.
Thank you both very much for joining.
Can I just say, sorry, that all profits from this, from the event and the sponsorship and raffle and so forth, will be going to St. Luke's Hospital. So this is a... I do mean...